Drive Time 91.3. Always on the cutting edge.
Welcome back. Not much attention has been paid to Abu Sayyaf's identification with the Islamic State, or ISIS, as kidnappings escalate around the Philippines' southern islands. The oldest group of hostages, two Canadians, one Norwegian and one Filipina, faced a looming deadline of execution. Only recently, the severed head of a Canadian hostage, John Ristall, was found on the streets of the Samal Island in the Philippines. Factions of the Abu Sayyaf group have captured a growing number of hostages in recent weeks and have issued various execution deadlines and ransom demands. In a video released by Abu Sayyaf, Ritzel asked the Canadian people and the world to do what was needed to meet the demands of his abductors, saying that otherwise he and the other hostages would be killed. Online is Varian Khan, editorial director for Terrorism Research and Analysis Consortium, TRAC for short. Varian, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Very much a neglected story, isn't it, the saga of Abu Sayyaf? I mean, they've been going for something like 20 years.
Absolutely, and they kidnap at an alarming rate. Certainly these kidnaps, because the kidnappings that we featured in our last report were of particular note because most of them were maritime-related, but they kidnap at least bi-monthly just locals and hold them for small amounts of ransom. It's a common practice amongst Abu Sayyaf for profit generation.
Now, just to give some background, who is and are Abu Sayyaf? I mean, where did they come from?
Well, right now it's an they're evolving in a completely different direction than how they've come from in the last, let's say, 20 years. They committed the largest act of terrorism on Filipino soil in the early 2000s, but since then, they have rapidly been closer and closer affiliating themselves with Islamic State, and their latest aspirations are to become the first official vilayet in the Pacific Rim.
Now, originally speaking, Abu Sayyaf arose out of some political dissatisfaction. Am I correct if I assume that right at the very beginning?
Yes, but they also have organizational criminal ties as well. And many people claim that they are only, you know, sort of idealistic as the forefront, that their criminal activities are really their primary motivational reasons.
So are you saying, in essence, that Abu Sayyaf might have a veneer of Islam City on it, but it is, to all intents and purposes, a criminal group?
Absolutely, yes. It's both, but I would say that their criminal activities are what they focused primarily on more than their religion.
Then there's something that I've read in some other stories where it said that in certain areas the local population actually supports Abu Sayyaf. Is that true?
Yes, well, in some of the more remote areas, Abu Sayyaf is the supporting local governance. So, you know, in the autonomous region that they, you know, thrive in, there's really not much, you know, tightened ways of governance to help the local population. So, yes, they do support them. And there are, you know, again, what you're saying, the original grievances that date back a very long time.
Now, Where did Abu Sayyaf get its Islamic identity from? I read somewhere that it was initially sort of an al-Qaeda type of identity that, as you say, has morphed into something else over the last two decades.
Oh, absolutely. It originally, you know, the Pacific Rim is very interconnected in how the Islamic sort of groups work with one another. So what you see in Indonesia or what you see in Malaysia is closely mirrored in what you see in the Philippines. So, and even with al-Qaeda groups, when they were all sort of al-Qaeda affiliated, they shared the same smuggling networks, they shared the same, support systems and safe houses, arms dealers, you name it, they sort of shared it as, you know, one and for all. So as these same groups migrated to the new kid on the block, Islamic State, so did the Filipino group. so and you see factions splitting off. I mean, because they're in so many little pockets or on little islands, a lot of times it takes sort of different little factions to get on board with the same concept, but they all are slowly but surely coming around. Abu Sayyaf itself as a group pledged to Baghdadi, and then you see smaller pledges coming about of groups from somewhere in between, little videos that get released of like 12 to 45 people, you know, again making their pledge.
Now, you say it's a whole lot of disparate groups over a whole lot of islands. Has the Philippine government made any efforts to try and police the situation?
I think the Philippine government's doing the best they can with what they have right now. They're known for their heavy-handedness in dealing with terrorist waves, and so often it swings popular support the wrong way, if that makes sense. They're known for a number of just police raids that were having sort of collateral damage that didn't apply to the militant operation that they were trying to, you know, ensnare at the time. And so as a result, their heavy-handedness has caused local populists to swing support towards Abu Sayyaf.
Now, why is this such a sort of an undercover story in the sense? Is it not as sexy as ISIS in the Middle East? Because if you look at it, Abu Sayyaf, as I say, have been around for much longer than some of the other groups that are getting all the headlines.
Oh, absolutely, it's not as sexy. I think that it's not undercover per se. Certainly the Pacific Rim press cover it in depth all the time. What you don't see is the international outcry that you see for even groups that are active in North Africa or obviously the Middle East, and certainly attacks on European or Western soil get much more attention. But, you know, we have hostages all over the world, and, you know, that have been held for long periods of time, just as Abu Sayyaf has held these Canadians in the Norwegian for over a year now, that no one pays much attention to, including the South African that's still being held in North Africa by AQIM.
Indeed. In fact, in the South African being held by AQIM, there have been moves afoot to try and extricate him from that situation, but negotiations are grinding, long, and require a tremendous amount of patience.
Absolutely, and I think that the negotiations here are very much under the veil of secrecy, because according to all the reports that you see in the Asian press, the Canadian government has refused to negotiate whatsoever, whereas you see the successful negotiation by at least the Indonesian company for the 10 Indonesians that were also kidnapped this month. So within a month's period of time, there's been four different sets of kidnappings that do not even involve this set of Westerners that are being held. All of these have been happening in the waters around the area, so it's much more maritime piracy. But you're seeing varying degrees of negotiation from either the Indonesians or the Malaysians that are getting their hostages free. Sometimes, I mean, one hesitates to comment on any governmental policy, but, you know, sometimes the hard and fast of we don't even talk is the fastest way to get your prisoners, you know, your hostages killed.
I mean, it's an iniquitous situation to be in. I think we all concede that. But do you think certain governments just need to understand the fact that they're not operating in an arena where things are going to be normal, so they will have to take sometimes abnormal actions, and sometimes you just have to negotiate? There's no other way.
Absolutely, and it might not involve actually paying money. You don't necessarily have to be supportive of a terrorist group in order to negotiate, at least to speak with them about the hostages that they're being held. I think the fact that the Indonesians negotiate for such a high ransom amount for their hostages that were accepted, and the refusal of the Canadian government to even speak, as far as we understand, to the hostage negotiators, didn't bode well for the execution yesterday. And it sort of came about in a way that, you know, they didn't execute all four as they were promised. They executed one, I believe, in hopes that they can negotiate ransoms for the other three.
It's a difficult situation, isn't it? At the very best and at the very worst, it's still difficult.
Absolutely. I mean, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. I mean, certainly paying for a hostage is, you know, the age-old problem. You just support more the cause that you're trying to avoid in the first place. At the same time, you know, if it was your loved one that was being held, I'm certain that you would do everything in your power to help them be freed.
And the battle against Abu Sayyaf is definitely not, doesn't appear to be going the Filipino way, because recent reports talk in one instance Abu Sayyaf killing 18 Filipino soldiers. That's not good news.
Yes, and that's actually contested, because Abu Sayyaf claimed they killed more. And, you know, the group that was in charge of these latest sets of hostages have been claimed, the brothers had claimed to have been killed a couple times by the Filipino government, and they're actually still alive and well. So it does seem a bit of a whack-a-mole, especially when they have a lot of hidey holes all over these, you know, various islands, some of which are in an autonomous region.
In fact, this issue of leaders suddenly dying has been revisited in many areas in Boko Haram, Abu Bakr Shekau. How many times have the Nigerian authorities said he's dead and he keeps on popping up?
Exactly. Not to mention his various and sundry body doubles that appear also dead.
Right.
And it's, there is not a ton of evidence to concede that killing a leader is actually going to kill your group. It depends on how strong the governance structure that comes up behind that leader is enacted in place to really say that beheading a terrorist organization by killing their leader is the most effective tool for ridding you of a terrorist group, a problem.
Viren, our final question, would you say that Abu Sayyaf in the Philippines, the ASG group, they're going to be around for some time. We just have to get used to it. We have to try and understand it and see how we can, what we can do.
Well, I think it's more than that. Right now there's a competition amongst jihadists in the Philippines, Indonesia, and Malaysia to become the very first Wilayah, officially recognized Wilayah from Baghdadi. Whoever gets that prize, whoever wins that lead, is going to entrench itself pretty well. I mean, more so than just being an established group that's been around for 20 years, you're going to get the name branding of Islamic State. We need to watch this and make sure that this doesn't happen in any one of those places.
Viren Khan, Editorial Director for the Terrorism Research and Analysis Consortium, known as TRAC for short. Thanks for chatting to us.
Thank you very much for having me. You have a wonderful day.
Thank you.